And thank you, Steve. Again, thank you to Zeithman's for hosting the series, for providing lunch. I do want to make sure that people sign in. There are three sign-in sheets. One is was on the table here, one was on the table in the middle, one was on the back table on that side. Particularly if you want to be able to claim this for credit, we do need your signature. I have had people after a class tell me they were there, they just didn't sign in. And my response is, that's great, but if you get audited, I can't tell people that. I can't tell them, well, they said they were here. That doesn't work. So please do make sure you sign in. But also for follow-up, afterwards, I like to send out a link to the audio recording and follow-up on items from the class, and to give notification about upcoming sessions. Like as Steve mentioned, we like to do another one in the spring. If people could please turn their cell phones to silent or vibrate or something along those lines, that would be extremely helpful. So this topic was actually requested. This is a by-request topic. Guard your tongue, the rules of ethical advertising. Keeping in line with guarding my tongue, I won't say who requested it, but it was someone who's in the room who asked for it, and now all of you have it. A little bit of history in terms of advertising in the industry. Certainly the veterans of the industry are aware of this. But for a long time, accountants were not able to advertise. It's in 1979, in response to a charter complaint, that the ICAO, Institute of Chartered Accountants of Ontario, forerunner of CPA Ontario, approved advertising, quote, in good taste. And, of course, that's a rather subjective thing, but that's what first permits advertising. Interestingly, the same thing was true in the U.S. Advertising was unprofessional until 1978. It's a very interesting thing, because when you deal with the practice of law, Canada prohibited lawyers from advertising long after the U.S. permitted it. But in terms of accounting, for some reason, it's until the late 70s. In the U.S., there was a Senate report that was involved with it. But in any case, the late 70s is when accountants are able to start advertising. What I'm not going to deal with as part of the conversation is the question of obeying the law when you advertise, as in honoring trademarks. I would hope that will be fairly straightforward in the sense that you have to follow those rules when you advertise. What I want to deal with instead are the cases that you see on your sheets in item number one. Above number one there, you see a book I recommend, Moral Issues of the Marketplace in Jewish Law, by Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine. Rabbi Dr. Levine, who passed away several years ago, was a major influence on me in terms of business ethics, and wrote extensively both in terms of the economics side of things, the financial side of things, and in terms of the Jewish side of things. But in number one, I give you my cases. Number one, Boast and Brag LLP advertises in the Globe and Mail that, quote, Canada's fastest growing firm of business advisors announces its newest partners, without providing any supporting information for the claim that they are Canada's fastest-growing firm of business advisors. Is that acceptable? Knee-jerk reaction.
No.
Even...
I mean, it may not be supportable, but that's their claim, that they're the fastest-growing, you know?
If it's not supportable.
Well, if it's not supportable, is that okay?
Is it a lie, in other words?
Are you misleading people? That would be the question. Okay, so we have a few people saying, no, you can't do it. You have someone who says, not necessarily, it's just a claim. We'll have to come back to this case. We're going to come back to all these cases. Second one, Bates and Switch, LLP. Yes, I need to find my humor somewhere. So this is it. Advertises services for preparing personal tax filings for Canadian citizens currently residing in Brazil. Their South American specialist left the firm 3 years ago. They have no plan to hire a replacement. They simply hope to bring in other business from these expatriates. Is that acceptable?
No.
No. Why not?
It's dishonest.
It's dishonest. It's misleading, but... They didn't claim they had a specialist on staff, right? But they did advertise a price for a fee, for a service that they're not going to provide. Someone's going to call them up and say, I'd like this. They're going to say, actually, we can't do that for you. However, Yeah, we do have a sale on whatever it is. Third case. Low and Lower LLP advertises a flat all-costs-included fee of $500 to prepare personal tax filings for individuals of low net worth and names a competitor who charges $2,500 to prepare personal tax filings for individuals of higher net worth.
Yeah, why not? As long as it's true,
here. They don't. What I should have clarified here is that they name the competitor who charges $2,500 for tax filings. They don't mention the fact that it's for different classes of clients. You don't mention that. You just say we ours is $500. Conditions apply, and you should know the competition is $2,500. Conditions apply. Is this okay?
So you're not saying they still prepare personal tax files. You're saying it's not the same thing.
It makes it sound like it's for the same service.
Right.
It is the same service, just different customers. So that's our third case. And then the last one, the marketing, this is terrible, I apologize, but I need an extreme case. The marketing consultant for financial planners, Meany & Lauder LLP, recommends a new advertising strategy, a campaign of daily emails to cancer patients, citing data on the frequency of relapse and emphasizing the need for estate planning. Bad taste. Recipients are offered special deals, which are good for only 24 hours. Is this acceptable? Okay, so these are the cases. So in order to address this, right, in order to address all of this, we actually need to start two steps back. Before we're going to talk about what you cannot do, we need to talk about why there is such a thing as advertising at all. Why is it in anyone's interest to permit advertising? Now, some of this is going to be obvious, but it's a point you need to make because otherwise you can just say, to use the Hebrew, we should just be machmir. We should just be strict and prohibit everything. You know, we'll allow you to have a business card that has your name and your business, but we're not going to let you go on radio or TV. We're not going to let you praise your work. We won't let you do any of that. Why is it that there's an imperative to let people make these sorts of claims? What's the rationale? Forget from a Jewish perspective for the moment. In secular society, why do we want advertising?
To draw customers.
Well, that's why the advertiser wants to advertise. Why is it good for society?
To provide information.
To provide information for whom?
Right.
So part of it is because the consuming public needs information about what their options are. It's good for the world if people know what their options are, then they can make their own decision about where they're going to take their business. That's one level. Another level, which was also suggested is, in one of the comments, is that it's good for the businesses, obviously. They want to be able to advertise. And then there's a third element, which I actually would note first, because it's less financial in nature, and that is freedom of expression. We live in a society that values freedom of expression. If you're going to tell people they're not allowed to inform others of their services, you are limiting their freedom of expression. That was the charter challenge, which opened up advertising in the first place. Take a look at source number two, please, from Ford v. Quebec.
The law, their action still is limited their expression.
Oh, yes, because it's a balance.
Then you go into basically a number of people who ask the person. Depending on defamation.
Yeah, no, that's true. There's always a balance for freedom of expression. That's for sure. Freedom of expression is free for things that I like, right? That's the general rule. Take a look at source number two from Ford v. Quebec, the Attorney General of Quebec. This was an issue in which Quebec had a rule that you could not advertise in English. Not like you need both. You couldn't advertise in English. So this was struck down by the Supreme Court, and look at what it says. Commercial expression, like political expression, is one of the forms of expression that is deserving of constitutional protection because it serves individual and societal values in a free and democratic society. Indeed, over and above its intrinsic value as expression, commercial expression, which protects listeners as well as speakers, plays a significant role in enabling individuals to make informed economic choices, an important aspect of individual self-fulfillment and personal autonomy. It's a claim that It's about free expression, first. And second, there's value in commercial expression. It's very interesting. When you read this decision, there are voices there, legal voices, judges, who are making the opposite argument, who are saying, no, commercial expression is not entitled to protection. It's not free expression. But this was indeed the decision that won the day and protected advertisement as freedom of expression. But certainly the main idea is that it's about helping consumers to make efficient business decisions. Source number three comes from the CPA code, courtesy of CPA Ontario, and it's in general the section on advertising is section 217. This is from guidance on 217.1. It is in the public interest and in the interest of all members and firms of CPA Ontario that members and firms be allowed to advertise or otherwise promote services available on the basis of fees charged. It's in the interest of society, as well as the members and firms who want to be able to advertise. And that's that's a core idea. I brought you source number four. We don't really need to read it through, but it's about consumer protection and the importance of having an empowered consumer body. There's also a separate idea, which I didn't bring sources for because it's a longer discussion, but it's worth noting. There's an argument that advertising, theoretically, will keep prices down. Even though the businesses have to invest in advertisement, from an economics perspective, the argument is that if you advertise, then your prices will go down. Why does that make sense? Right, it increases competition. When it increases competition, now everybody knows that they have 10 other options besides mine. I'm going to have to lower my prices in order to get customers. In practice, studies show this doesn't really play out. And the reason it doesn't play out is because of psychology, consumer psychology. When I see a price advertised that's lower, noticeably lower than everybody else's, my gut reaction is they must not be as good. Right? It's not as good quality. There's a connection that we make between low price and low quality.
But then you have price matches, basically. Who cares?
Right, so price match is a different story. This is true, but that won't necessarily lower prices.
No. If somebody advertised the price, then basically that advertising is great because you go to another store which you trust.
Correct. Right. No, but what they found in fields where you don't have price matching, a lot of the studies are in law specifically, is that this doesn't, advertisement does not actually lower the cost of the business. It doesn't play out that way in economics. Someone was going to say, there was a hand over here? No? Okay. Those are the three reasons why advertising is seen as valuable from a secular perspective. From a halachic perspective, from a Jewish perspective, two of these levels obtain. Freedom of expression is not really such an issue, meaning we don't really have in Judaism this concept of open freedom of expression. We have all sorts of rules about the way that you are allowed to speak. We don't prohibit speech if you don't violate the Torah's laws, if you're not speaking slanderously, not tale-bearing, and so on. But there's no value of, let's make sure everybody gets to talk. That's not something that you'll see. What you do have, though, is protection of the needs of consumers and protection of the needs of businesses, and that's certainly seen. There's a body of literature on protecting consumer interest in Judaism. I brought you source number five, which was a classic. There's a type of offering which a woman brings in the time of a Beis Hamikdash when there is a temple. So there's a type of offering, a bird offering, that's brought after giving birth. Question arises, what if a woman has a baby and then didn't bring the offering for whatever reason, and then a couple of years later has another baby? Does she bring one offering, or does she bring multiple offerings? So that's behind what you're going to see here in source number five, a lesson from the Mishnah, core legal text of Jewish jurisprudence. I'm going to read the English, even though I have the Hebrew here for everybody as well, but in the interest of time, I'm going to stick to the English. Once, bird offerings in Jerusalem cost gold dinarim. You had to spend a couple of gold dinar to buy bird offerings. That was considered to be exorbitant. It's way too much. So Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel swore. He said, by the temple, I will not sleep tonight until they just cost standard dinarim. Instead of the gold, I'm going to drop the price. How does he drop the price? He entered the court and he taught the following. a woman who needs to bring offerings for multiple births or multiple impurities would bring only one offering. He said, you know what, however many kids you've had since the last time you brought a carbon, since the last time you brought the offering, one offering is all that's required, and burnt offerings dropped to a quarter dinar that day because now there was no more demand. Now you had a whole bunch of birds you couldn't sell. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel intervenes, and there's a lot of discussion about what exactly he was doing here. Was he inventing a leniency? Was he relying on a standard existing leniency that just wasn't publicly known? But he intervenes in halacha in order to protect consumers, in order to protect the customer. This applies not only in the times of a temple. You'd say, well, this was relevant to, you know, when you had a temple, and God willing, soon we have one again. But until then, why is this relevant? And the answer is, how many of you buy gefilte fish? No, seriously, how many of you eat gefilte fish? Okay? Fair number of people eat gefilte fish. Well, if you eat gefilte fish, you know, first of all, that in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years or so, they've really driven up the price. I remember when I was in university and I would go to the grocery store and it was a cheap thing to get. And somewhere along the line, between then and now, it changed radically, went up in price. Well, if you go back to the 16th century, 16th, 17th century, they had a problem with the price of fish in the marketplace, because the merchants were driving up the price on Fridays, knowing that Jews wanted this for their meals on Shabbat. So you know what they did? The Tzemach Tzedek, not the second Lubavitcher Rebbe, the other Tzemach Tzedek, issued a ban prohibiting eating fish on Shabbos. He prohibited eating fish on Shabbos, and that was it. Break the cartel. No more demand, price goes down. Happened again, the Magen Avraham, Rav Avraham Gambiner in the 17th century did it as well. Lest someone ask, why shouldn't we do the same thing today for certain foods before Pesach? The answer is, if you have communal unity, there's an awful lot you can do. We are a community of strike breakers, so that's part of the problem. But this idea is that we look to protect the consumer. I brought you in source number 6, the Hebrew's on the bottom of one side, and then it continues onto the next slide with the English. Talking about competition, Rabbi Yehuda said, a store owner may not distribute parched grain and nuts to children, for this would accustom them to come to him. You want to get the kids into your store so that they bring the parents along with them, and you give out sweets. He says that's not fair. But the sages permit. Rabbi Yehuda also said you shouldn't lower your prices to such a point where you undermine everybody else. And the sages say, no, you do that, you're remembered for the good. And on that, the Talmud explains, what is the logic of the sages? Why is it that the sages are okay with the idea of these forms of competition? And their answer is, because this will cause the rate to broaden. Meaning, if you will allow people these tactics, the consumer is going to benefit, and therefore we're okay with undermining other merchants in the interest of the good of the consumer. So you have an emphasis here on trying to look after the consumer. We also do have an emphasis on looking after the need of the business. We have had other sessions on the issue of unfair competition, opening up next door to somebody else in the same line of business and the like. So it's not as though it's all biased towards the consumer. But what I hope we've established here in the opening segment is that advertising, as a means of protecting the consumer and as a means of strengthening the proprietor, applies both as a value in secular society and in Jewish society. The added element in secular society is freedom of expression. That's really not as strong an issue for us. So those are the reasons why you would want to enable advertising, and why it's not so simple to simply say, well, let's just prohibit all the things that are problematic, because you have an imperative to enable advertising. You don't want to you don't want to prevent it. So now that brings us to the flip side, which is, okay, so what are the concerns? What are the problems when you're going to follow through and enable advertising? And since I saw some people have come in, please make sure that you sign in. Where are the 3 sign-in sheets at this point? There's one over here. There's one over here, and there's one on that table back there. So please make sure that you sign in, particularly if you would like credit for it, but also if you want notification of classes. Okay, so I brought you a big chunk here of section 217 in source number 7, and there's a lot to talk about here. The first most major concern and we'll be talking about it from a secular perspective and a Jewish perspective, is the issue of false advertising and misleading advertising. So if you take a look at 217.1 in source number 7, advertising and promotion. A member or firm may advertise or seek publicity for the members or firm's services, achievements, or products, and may seek to obtain new engagements and clients by various means, but shall not do so directly or indirectly in any manner, A, which the member or firm knows or should know, is false or misleading, or which includes a statement the contents of which the member or firm cannot substantiate. Right? So Nathan, this takes us back to our first case. Right? If you can't substantiate it, you have a problem. That's a basic point. Not only that, I thought this was interesting. If you jump to the first guidance that I have in number 7, the guidance number 3 to 217.1, members in firms that engage public relations, recruiting, or other agents are responsible for ensuring that no activity for which the agent is engaged contravenes the CPA code. So I hire a firm, and they create marketing materials for me, and somebody complains that the material was misleading. I'm not able to say, well, that was their mistake, I'm going to fire them. It's me. It's on me to make sure that whatever is put out for my firm in my name is honest and is not going to mislead anybody. I brought you some examples of what constitutes misleading following this. In Guidance 217.1, Note 6. Members and firms should ensure at all times that any public reference in promotional material, websites, stationery, reports, etc., to themselves or their services is accurate. The following are examples of false or misleading references. Any implication that the practicing unit is larger than it is, such as by use of plural descriptions or other misleading use of words. Any implication that a person is a partner of a firm when the person is not. Any reference to particular services of any person or firm where the person or firm is not currently able to provide those services, right? Reminiscent of the bait and switch case. Any statement that the practice is restricted to one or more functions if assignments are accepted in other practice functions. I say we only deal with, except when we're dealing with other things, right? That doesn't work. The next piece, any reference to fees which is intended for the information of the public, including prospective clients, should not be misleading. The following are examples of false or misleading fee references. Fee information, if the service at the fee specified will not be available on an ongoing basis for a reasonable length of time. I'm not sure what reasonable means. As a general rule, when you deal with the accounting code, as opposed to the one for lawyers, interestingly, the accounting code is very much meant to be applied in a common sense way. That's the answer you get when you ask particular questions. It's not like we're going to tell you 1 week is a reasonable time, 6 days is not a reasonable time. It's much more what in general is a common sense thing. When you look at the lawyer's code, it's very specific about what they want and what they don't want in their code of professional conduct. A quotation of specific fee information, if the service at the fee specified is conditional upon the acceptance by the client of other services, unless such condition is disclosed. Right? You can't advertise and say, I am going to prepare your personal taxes for, fill in the blank, for $500, but only if you are also going to use us for investment advice, only if whatever it is, unless you tell people up front. That's what we do. That's a different story. Right. Well, it's not bait and switch. The classic bait and switch is one service for another. It's bait and switch on price, effectively, which is simply just deception.
No, but it also applies this to the because you're baiting and you're doing this and this for this price.
Okay.
You have to do this and this at this price.
Right. I hear you. That's a fair point. These concerns that are found in secular law, or in this case the secular code, are found in halacha, are found in Jewish law as well, both in terms of business in general and in terms of advertising. So take a look at source number 8. Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda points out that the Torah speaks about having honest weights and measures. And it talks about having a hin tzedek, an honest hin. And here's the problem. The biblical verse that mentions having an honest hin, a hin being, again, a volume measure, is that the Torah in this verse requiring honest weights and measures lists an ephah, which is a volume measure, and let's say hin, which is a volume measure. So it would be the equivalent of somebody saying, you shall have honest measures. honest leaders and half leaders. Hey, whatever you want to use. I'm trying to come up with two volume measures. So honest leaders and half leaders. It was much easier if you're dealing with the American system, right? Honest pints and gallons. You have different names. It's not all on the basis of one word. But the point is, you don't need to say that. You shall have honest pints. You shall have honest gallons. Once you say one, I know the other. And that's what the Talmud here is picking up on. Courts ditto for the same system. But it's just superfluous. And the Talmud is bothered by the superfluous reference to hin and epha. And it says, you know what? The word hin doesn't have to mean a volume measure. The word hin can also be taken as hain, which means yes. And the idea is that when you say yes, it has to be honest. It's not telling me about an honest measure. It's telling me about an honest yes. To say, as you see in source number 8, why does the Torah say a just hin? Isn't the hin included in the reference to a just epha? Rather, it teaches that your yes, when you say yes, hin, it should be just. And when you say no, it should be just. In other words, you have to stick by your word. Applying it in an advertising case, source number 9, Maimonides, Rambam. One may not deceive people in commerce or, quote, steal their minds, what's called in Hebrew, gnevat da'at. Whether non-Jewish or Jewish doesn't matter. One who knows his merchandise is blemished must inform the consumer. Even stealing minds verbally, speaking in a way that will deceive people, is prohibited. And a practical advertising example, one may not mix two batches of produce, even new with new and certainly old with new, right? I'm out in the supermarket and I want to take some of the onions or the apples or whatever it is, and they put a nice layer on top that looks good, expecting me to just pull out a bunch and put them in the bag without looking at what's below. So that would be something that you would not be allowed to do. That's a dishonest practice. Note that we don't rely on the customer to figure it out. We don't say caveat emptor, it's up to the customer to do the research. It's the advertiser who is making a specific statement, who is expected to be honest in making that statement. But here I want to go back to the bait and switch case. On the one hand, the bait and switch case is misleading, right? The customer is being drawn into a conversation that the customer never wanted to have. Customer thought he was calling up for this service, and in fact, that service is not available. But in what way have you harmed the customer? At the end of the day, the customer calls up and says, I want tax services for Canadians living in Brazil. You say, sorry, we're actually not offering that right now. Customer says, it was in your ad. He says, yeah, I know, I'm sorry, but we do have these other things. Customer says, goodbye, hangs up the phone. You haven't hurt the customer. You wasted their time. Sorry? If we could make wasting someone's time illegal, right? I mean, that's not... Really? We're going to impose a limit because you're wasting somebody's time?
You create false expectations.
You create false expectations. See, I think from the secular perspective, the reason why you're not allowed to do this is just because it's a function of deception. In other words, even where you're not hurting, there's no cost beyond just you took the guy's time. Nonetheless, even if you didn't have a financial cost, you did something dishonest, and we don't want dishonest speech.
You're impacting the profession, after all, right? Like, I mean, you know, you want to rein in your members, so, you know, if somebody's doing something like that, it's affecting the whole profession. As a whole.
Right, it's an interesting point. This actually may be, we're going to talk about bringing disrepute on the profession as a separate item, but maybe bait and switch would come under that as well. Yes?
I was going to say that even though we're not going to consider stealing of time. How about stealing of expectation and that you're disappointed and that by not going to the proper person to do your taxes for Brazil,
right.
You've lost the chance to get that.
Right, but normally we don't restrict free speech on the grounds of you're disappointing me. Right? Again, I mean, can you imagine? We could just throw all the political candidates out. No, I mean that. Yeah.
Can't go into a store if you have no intention of buying a product because you're raising the storekeeper's hope.
Ah, See, now we get into halacha. Right. What halacha requires is separate. I'm talking about it from a secular perspective. I think the only grounds to prohibit bait and switch from a secular perspective are either because it's generally part of misleading advertising, and even though this doesn't have a financial cost to it, nonetheless, we don't want misleading advertising, or Nathan's argument that maybe it brings disrepute on the profession. Within Judaism, you have a whole other issue, and that's the issue of what's called onas devarim, using your speech in a way that will harm others, even in terms of emotional harm. Take a look at source number 10, please. This is a comment of Rabbi Menachem and Meiri on the Gemara of Bava Metzia. Asur lahonos, one may not abuse another and cause him loss with his words. Loss sounds like financial loss. Thus, the Mishnah says, one may not say to someone, how much does this item cost, when he doesn't wish to buy it. I'm not supposed to go into a store with zero expectation of buying anything and just ask him, so how much is this? Now you'll say to me, well, I didn't take anything from him. That's true, but I raised his hopes. He thinks I'm a customer. He doesn't know that I'm just a nudnik. Right? He thinks that there's a possibility of a sale, and I raise his hopes. But not only that, look what he adds. Because he, the customer, is embarrassed to say that he doesn't wish to buy, he has to now explain himself, so he instead insults the merchandise, saying that it is not worth this much, right? You walk into the store, you ask for the price, and then you're just going to walk away. You don't want to look like it's that you're cheap or that you're unable to afford it. You say, eh, that's not worth it. Well, when you say that's not worth it, others hear. Right? Others are going to hear you, and that causes the merchant a loss. So he's finding a financial harm, but then he adds, and even if no one is present, so you say to me, there's no financial harm in doing this, still he strains the merchant and causes him pain, for he expects to sell, and he does not sell. I am not allowed to use my speech in such a way that it's going to inflict pain on another person. Cheryl.
What if the person has a sheath sword and goes into the other sheath sword and ask price with no intention of buying, but he wants to know what the merchandise is selling for so he can adjust his price.
Does the other fellow know who this person is? Does the person, in other words...
No.
Oh, so he doesn't know. So now you're just asking his price for the sake of your store, and he doesn't even realize that he's talking to his competition.
Right.
Right. So on the face of it, the competition aspect of it isn't problematic. But yes, this is an issue of raising his expectations. Besides, you can just go to his website, really. Yes.
Excuse me, my name is Marlene.
Hi, Marlene.
I'm sorry if I'm late. Anyways, when you go into the store, so you're not supposed to say how much something is?
So if you're a serious, you know, if you're a potential customer, then it's fine to ask. But if you know I have zero intention and I'm just, you know, going to raise their expectations by doing so for the sake of satisfying my curiosity, then I have a problem. Now, we actually did this. We had a class here last year, the year before, on what's called showrooming. Right, which is the practice of going into the store, having them actually demonstrate an item for you so that you can go buy it online. You have no intention whatsoever of buying it or even buying it from them. And their businesses have tried to shut that down with zero success. Zero success. It never works. And some businesses have actually embraced it on the theory that every customer interaction is useful. Either because maybe I'll be able to convince them to buy it, or because they feel like you have people in the store, that in and of itself creates an atmosphere of a healthy commercial enterprise, and other people will come in and be interested. We had this situation. I visited my in-laws in Atlanta, and there's a chain of stores, I forget which one it was, that has stores in Canada and also has stores in the U.S., and I'm not going to buy the thing there and lug it back. I'm going to buy it here. But I wanted to try it out. So I said to the person right there, I said, listen, we're not going to buy it. We're from Toronto. We're going to go back to Toronto, and that's where we're going to look at purchasing. It, is it okay still? Are you okay showing it to us? And her answer was yes. She considered it to be worthwhile. I assume that if there was somebody else in the store who was actually, you know, an interested customer on the spot, she might have said, you know what, come back later. But I think that it requires that we be honest and upfront. The one caveat that I would make, and it's really part of the showrooming class in general, but just it's worth noting, is a lot depends on expectations. Meaning, it's no longer true that every merchant thinks that every person in the store is a customer. It could be that culturally it was that way at some point in time, but today any proprietor knows that the people wandering around their store could be just, you know, using up time while they wait for somebody, could be just curious about how things look and they're imagining in their head a redesign of their home or whatever it is, could be a bona fide customer, could be showrooming and just waiting till the chance to buy it online. If they know, and there's no raising of expectations when they see you, that changes the calculation. So a lot depends on the situation, on the type of interest shown. Do I ask the salesperson to actually help me with the item, or do I just look at it? There are all sorts of different elements to this. I'm going to take these two questions, and then we're going to go further. Faye.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and then Gershon.
Oh.
Don't worry.
So I'm just thinking, let's say you're not interested in buying right that moment, but when you look at it, it's beginning to look better and better, and the person shows it to you. This is how it works. This
yeah.
is what you can do to it.
That's great.
So he has a potential customer.
Yes.
You don't know it yet. He doesn't know it yet.
Yeah. Right. So then this is fine. Yeah.
The question is whether, it's going to sound like a coastage, but whether another story is really applicable today in so far that you go into a shop and say, how much is this? And he tells it to you, but then he says to you, well, thank you for coming in. The question is, why is he saying thank you for coming in? Is he showing me?
Right. Again, a lot is. Right.
Is it maybe cultural? I don't know.
Right. Now, I think a lot of it is situation dependent. But what I'm trying to show you is, and it's in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 11 as well, is that we have this concept of not speaking to somebody in a way that's going to cause them pain. And I will apply this to the bait and switch situation. Bait and switch may be prohibited in the secular system because of issues of honesty and dishonesty, or because of issues of bringing the profession into disrepute. But from a Jewish perspective, it's a separate problem. I cause somebody pain. They're sitting there, they're looking for a service. I advertise that I have it. I know full well that I don't have it. And now they are going to put their hopes on this, contact me, and find out that actually, no, it was not available. So that's one set of issues. The misleading advertising, generally misleading, and bait and switch. The next type, this is my favorite, is the unfavorable advertising about other members or firms. This is always fun. So take a look back in source number 7 at that top paragraph in number 7. 217.1, but now we're looking at B, with a list of things you're not allowed to do. So B was, you're not allowed to engage in advertising which makes unfavorable reflections on the competence or integrity of the profession or any member or firm. No negative advertising. The issue of negative advertising is explained in source number 12. This is the guidance on that line. It says, since any member or firm may be able to offer services similar to those offered by others, it is not appropriate for any member or firm to claim superiority with respect to the competence or integrity of any other member or firm. So, what's their issue? Why don't they like negative advertising? What's the line say?
Offer similar services.
Yeah. Who do you think you are? You say you're better than them. Right? They're also members. They're also firms. And therefore, they can do it too. That seems to be the objection. Really, what they're doing essentially is lumping this prohibition under general false and misleading advertisement. That seems to be their problem. Yeah.
And what if your firm actually does a superior service?
Yeah. It sounds like if it's true, if I can demonstrate that this is true, there should be nothing wrong. Right? If I can show we sold more houses than, it's not an accounting thing, or a financial services thing, but if I can demonstrate we filed more returns than anybody else in the province, and we have the numbers to show for it, you know, what's your issue? It should be just fine to make that claim. Within halacha, within Jewish law, it's actually not so straightforward. Take a look at source number 13. Passage from Talmud, from the Talmud Yerushalmi. Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina said, one who is honored by the shame of others has no share in the next world. You can't elevate yourself via negative statements about other people. Now, you'll tell me that's a nice statement, but that's not halacha, right? That's not law. That's okay, because we have more sources.
Are you making it negative?
Right, so part of it is...
Or just boasting about your...
Correct. So part of it has to be a distinction between saying I'm good and saying others are bad.
Right.
That's absolutely true. But take a look at number 14. This is the issue of inappropriate competition. This source, Rabbi Shlomo Yehuda Tavak, the Erech Shai, is talking about the issue of lowering your price in order to undermine others. Okay, where you're not going to profit, but your goal is to drive others out of business. And he says, where he reduces the price in order to harm the other, thinking neither I nor you will gain, then even where he does this in order to induce the other to pay him, he wants to get the other guy to pay him something, so there's a positive thing he wants in this. Nonetheless, we compel him not to act as Sodom. The trade of the city of Sodom, biblically, is that they are interested in not in stealing from others, but in saying, I am, even if I can't profit, I don't want you to gain. And that's what you're doing here, is you're undermining the progress of others. That's his objection when it comes to competition. And it certainly applies here as a function of, aside from the issue of inappropriate competition, because now it's a scorched earth type of a thing, I'm going to undermine them, but it certainly has a separate issue, which is the law of Lashon Hara. Someone asked me in the beginning whether we're going to talk about Lashon Hara, the laws of harmful speech. So take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, also known as the Chafetz Chaim. He says, know that just as one may not speak poorly of another person, so one may not speak poorly about his property. And he says, this is very common due to our great sins that a particular merchant speaks poorly about another merchant's goods and the like due to jealousy. This is fully included in the biblical prohibition against harmful speech. So there, it's even if it's true, right? That would be a distinction. The secular system does not like it if I say negative things about others because, well, it may not be true, but implying that if it is true, then I'm good. In the Jewish system, Lashon Hara is where it is true. So that's another distinction between the two systems. Last element, or next to last element. Bring disrepute on the profession. Flip back again, please, to source number 7. We're looking at line C. The third type of advertising they don't want you to do is advertising which otherwise brings disrepute on the profession. Anything that makes financial services professionals look bad. An example of that would be source number 16 on the guidance. Improperly claiming specialist status may violate one or more of the following rules. Rule 201.1, which requires members and firms to act in a manner that will maintain the good reputation of the profession. If you tell people I'm a specialist and they contact you and you don't know what you're talking about, I mean, there actually is, the CPA code has a whole bunch of rules for defining who qualifies as a specialist. But if you don't have it, then that makes the whole profession look bad. People think that's what a specialist is. Sorry?
The rules of conduct and law society.
Yeah, law society is similar.
Exact same term.
Yeah. The claim of being a specialist when you're not is not only bad in the sense of deception, but it's also bad in that you bring disrepute on the profession, and again, the bait and switch may put you in the same category. Within Jewish law, you think that's a concern, bringing disrepute on the profession? Under what law? There is no such thing as a profession from the Jewish perspective. There is no accounting profession as a unit. There are professional relationships. Someone hires you to do a job, but there's no such thing as the profession. Such, you know, it's a chilul Hashem, right? It's a chilul accounting. I have desecrated the name of accounting. There's no such thing. When I dealt with this under the discussion of lawyers, it was a different story. When I spoke to lawyers on this topic, it was different. Because law, as an entity within Judaism, has a special standing, and there's an issue of bringing disrepute upon the Torah and upon its law. But disrepute on accounting is not really a concern that we have. The last area, and then we're going to apply this quickly to the four cases. The issue of advertising, which is harassment. So take a look, please, at source number 17. This is Rule 217.2. Notwithstanding Rule 217.1, which already told me not to engage in advertising which is misleading and so on, a member or firm shall not, either directly or indirectly, solicit in a manner that is persistent, coercive, or harassing any professional engagement. So I want a definition here. I want something better to explain what this means. So I look at the guidance. Communication with a prospective client should cease when the prospect so requests, either directly to the member or firm or through CPA Ontario. Any continued contact will be regarded as harassment, which is contrary to the rule. That's all you get in terms of defining this this category of persistent, coercive, or harassing. I would think it's broader than continuing to bother them when they say, I'm not interested. I would expect it to be broader. Within Jewish law, as Rabbi Dr. Levine approaches it, there's also a prohibition. It's what's called lo tachmod. Lo tachmod, one of the Ten Commandments, number 10, not to desire the property of others and make moves to obtain it. So take a look at source number 18. From the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. One who desires another person's servant, maid, home, or implement, or anything he can purchase from him, and who weighs him down with third parties and badgers him until he can buy it, violates this prohibition of lo tachmod. You're not supposed to desire it, in meaning you're not supposed to persist in trying to get it. And it's not only in terms of a purchaser, but also a seller. Source number 19, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, in his Pitrei Choshen on the laws of business, writes, I have seen one who wrote that the same applies for one who pushes another person to buy from him. This involves the prohibition against Hamas, taking somebody's money by force. His words appear to be correct. He agrees with that position. You can't coerce someone else into a business deal. It's a violation of lo tachmod. So what we've said, to sum up everything we've done in a nutshell, is that both systems recognize a value in advertising, a positive value in advertising. Both systems prohibit false and misleading ads, bait and switch, even if bait and switch has different reasons. In the secular system, because it's misleading or brings disrepute. In the Jewish system, because you've caused somebody pain with your words. They prohibit harassment of potential clients. Judaism tends to be more concerned about the unfavorable advertisement about others and this issue of Lashon Hara, speaking negatively about them or undermining them in competition, as opposed to the secular system, which is just concerned that your ad may not be true. And the secular system is worried about the disrepute for the profession, which in Judaism doesn't seem to be a concern. Sorry?
When you're saying bait and switch, all these matters are basically competition bureau.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I looked into it in terms of the Competition Act as well, and they seem to leave a lot out in terms of definitions. Okay. Okay. Yeah, no, I mean, I can show you what I have from it, but I'd be curious. Yeah, email me. Email me. Send me what you got. Okay. In terms of the application out of our cases. So our first case was the case of the advertisement, Canada's fastest growing firm of business advisors announces its newest partners. So take a look at source number 20. This is from an article in CA Magazine. I didn't actually see it in CA Magazine. I saw it in a textbook called Auditing an International Approach, which is as thrilling a read as it sounds. It's actually not a bad read. But in 1987, three charges were brought against, quote, a partner of Ernst & Whinney in Ontario. The discipline committee found the member not guilty on the first charge, but guilty on the second and third. Both guilty charges concerned a 1985 ad he had placed in the Globe and Mail that stated, in part, Canada's fastest growing firm of business advisors announces its newest partners. The committee found the ad misleading in two ways. First, accountants do not have a monopoly on the term business advisors. Second, the claim was made on the basis of statistics that were, quote, accurate as they relate to the participating chartered accountant firms, but without disclosure of the necessary parameters or basis for the statement, it is misleading. You have to explain your statistic. You have to justify it in the ad. The member received a written reprimand, was assessed court costs of $6,000, and was fined $5,000. So in the secular system, this is considered to be deception. Frankly, I'm not so sure it will be deception in halacha. In other words, it has a justification. It's not absent justification. If you take a look at source number 21, I think this would be the answer for that case in Jewish law. He's dealing with a separate issue within advertising, but I want to point you to the line at the end of this source of 21 where he says consumer surveys could prove very helpful here. In other words, it's how people interpret your ad it's only deceiving if people are deceived. And sometimes you have to take a poll in order to determine whether something is truly considered to be deceiving. That's in terms of case number one. Case number two, the bait and switch case. We don't have anybody who deals with Canadians living in Brazil. So that's very clearly prohibited in CPA Ontario guidance, right, under bait and switch, and also within Halacha. The deceptive comparison, where I talk about my fee for tax filings for low-income people, and I compare it with the fee that my competition is charging for people of higher income and more complex cases. So it would violate the rules for misleading in CPA Ontario. I think that's very clear because of the misleading nature of the comparison. And for us, it's a problem as well. I brought you source number 22, the last source, in which Rabbi Yochanan says, if you sell a cow and you say, this cow gores, bites, kicks, and sprawls. You list four defects. And it only has one of those defects. And that's one of these four. The consumer can come back to you and claim, I bought this by accident, I didn't know, I was even cheated into doing so, into buying it. Why? Because he looks at a list of four defects. And he says, you know, he says it gores, bites, kicks, and sprawls. It's not sprawled. Clearly, he's just overstating it. And on that basis, he buys it. He doesn't test out all four. So therefore, that's considered to be a deceptive statement by the seller. You're not allowed to make deceptive statements that will mislead people, and I think that's true in the case of the comparison. The last case, the case of the ad campaign in targeting people who are suffering from cancer and say that, you know, you need to make estate plans. So would this qualify as harassment, under the CPA Ontario rules? Certainly in the Jewish rules, I think this is out. I think it comes under lo tachmod, right? Trying to pressure somebody for their assets. And I think it also comes under onat devarim, right? You know, using your speech to abuse somebody else, to harm somebody else. What do you think about the CPA Ontario guidelines? Would it say that this was a problem? This kind of targeted AI campaign?
I think the first one to do it was that would have that problem. But down the road, if it became common, they probably would allow it.
Interesting. So it's context-driven. Interesting. I hear. I don't know. I didn't find this discussed anywhere. In law, you can't get away with this. In law, it's very clear. You can't do that kind of a campaign. But I'm not sure how this would be taken.
So the CPA number 17.
Yeah.
17-1. Yeah. Member of first time to directly or directly in management for harassing.
Right, but this is not. Well, that's the question. Is this harassing? When you send somebody a mailing that says, you know, you should think about estate planning, right? That's every day. Right.
That's harassing
when you send it every day. That's a different discussion. But, yes?
Wouldn't it only be deemed harassing if they declined or unsubscribed or rejected at any point?
So if they reject,
ignoring, would you be reminders?
Right. So it's for sure that if they say no, right, that we had explicitly in the guidance. If they say we don't want this, then you have no grounds for pursuing them at all. My question is, would this be where they don't even know yet? I'm launching this. Do I have to consider that this might be considered harassment just because I'm pushing someone in a time of vulnerability to take advantage of my services? Shoshana, you want to? No? That's the fundamental question is, am I pushing them at a time when they are weak? I mean, you could make the argument reasonably that they do need my services now. Right? It's actually in their best interest. You could make that argument. I'm not sure that we're going to say just because they're vulnerable, therefore they shouldn't have access to advertising. So that's an interesting question. So how do you balance their need with the fact that they're vulnerable and you don't want to hurt them? I'm not sure. I think this is an interesting question to pursue.
The ad has to be very sensitive.
Yeah.
For the people you're doing. That's fine.
Right.
As long as it's sensitive.
Okay, but now that has to be, you have to figure out what that looks like.
Then you have to.
That's not, I don't think that's straightforward, but I think you're right.
Could it be in the same category as an ambulance chaser?
So, right, so in law, there are actual very clear, there are very clear rules about not doing this sort of thing. The lawyer is not entitled to do this. But in the accounting, it's not as clear cut. Yes? Right, so you'd have to do some kind of partnership in some way with health providers, with healthcare providers, in order to get this information. Well, if we say that this is harassing, then no. Not only that, they get in trouble for disclosing a person's health situation. So, yeah, so you have to figure out, I'm not sure how you would actually do this in practice, how you would get the information. But I bet someone who wants to do this can come up with a way to get the information. I mean, it's not hard to imagine. I can come up with at least two ways that somebody could do this, but I don't want to say them on tape. They recorded. But I don't have the recorder. I can tell you what I think. Yeah?
If you go to a shiva house, there are certain things you're not allowed to bring up with the availance, with the availance,
right?
Because their expenses are down.
Right.
They might, you cover the furniture because, you know, they might say, well, can I buy your furniture or something like that? But your expenses are down, so you don't take advantage of that situation. So apparently the cancer patients, my son also has a defensive sound, presumably. So maybe you shouldn't take advantage of that as well.
Right. No, that's the vulnerability issue. Right. Not just in terms of advertising, you're saying, but even going beyond that, just in general, engaging in that which can take advantage of their vulnerability. Okay, thank you very much. And again, thank you to Zeitman for hosting the series, and to Steve and Reem for enabling it. God willing, we'll have another series in May. Please remember, if you did not yet sign up, on the sign-up sheets, please make sure you sign in for follow-up on this class and notification about the next series. Thank you very much.